Welcome to the Andy Griffin Show.
Wake up!
With your chance to sound off, give your opinion, and tell us your thoughts. It's on.
It's now.
It's here. It's the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5, KDXU, Southern Utah's news talk leader.
Hey, happy Wednesday to you on this sixth day of December 2023. How are you doing? I'm Andy Griffin. You getting some sound there, Doc? Is it too? Can you hear me okay?
It's okay. I don't need to.
I have a volume button down here, but people keep messing with it, so I don't know. Dr. David Blodgett is with me today, and I don't know why your headphones aren't working right.
No, it's good.
We'll get it figured out. Thanks for coming in. He makes his monthly visit. The doctor is in the house.
That's wonderful.
Well, house call. I love it.
Great to be here, Andy. I appreciate the chance.
Well, it's 5 years now. I know you've been coming a lot longer than that, but with me, 5 years.
Yeah.
In February 1st will be 5 years.
I'm beginning to expect the unexpected when I come here, so it's good.
Well, you have indulged my odd questions and grilling, and actually come through with flying colors pretty much every time. So,
yeah, thank you. But it's an opportunity to talk about things that are important and get them out there. So I appreciate the opportunity.
So I have a list. Let's start with your list, though. What stuff coming up? What, you know, is it some kind of health awareness month? What kind of things? I know. One of your concerns right now has been because people are disenamored, not happy with the COVID vaccine. They are, some unfortunately, choosing to issue all vaccines. They're saying, if that one doesn't work, maybe none of them work. And that's a real concern.
It is. And so we're seeing a drop off in childhood immunizations. So all those diseases that used to kill thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of kids every year, we're seeing fewer people vaccinating for that, which will leave us open for epidemics and return of diseases we just haven't seen for a long time or very rarely. And then it also shows up in this time of year in flu shots. People aren't, you know, our flu shot rates are down. And so, there's the lessening the severity of the disease that can happen, but also the deaths that happen in the high-risk groups. So the highest risk groups for flu are the elderly, much like COVID was, and babies, right? And so... So, but even for everybody else that might not die from flu, not having to spend two weeks out of work, and if you've had flu, it's a specific disease, right? Enter cold and flu season like this, and we have dozens of different diseases going around, and you know, so COVID's entered that mix, but we have other coronaviruses that were here before COVID, and we have rhinovirus and adenovirus and
RSV.
There's just this whole spectrum of diseases that hit this time of year, and so people say, well, I got sick even though I got the flu shot, but that's not the question. It's whether you got influenza A, which is a whole different game and much more severe generally than the rest of them. So last year, flu overtook COVID again as the number one.
Flu's back on top. Yay!
In the world, and it will. I'm sure it will do it this year as well. So we haven't really had the big, you know, always this time of year we start to wonder when the peak of flu will happen, sometime in between now and February. And, 60, 70, 80, 90,000 people die from the flu every year. So,
I have a question about that. I read something, and it was one of those things that myths dispelled. You know, things that we all believed but aren't necessarily true. And it talked about flu and cold and flu season and cold weather. Are they or are they not related? Cold weather and cold and flu season.
They are. The question is why. So that's okay. People have tried to figure out why is it that it is cold and flu season, right? And so they wonder if it's that our immune system dampens a little bit. Maybe we don't have as much sunlight, so, you know, that can do it.
Yeah.
I think it has a lot to do with we don't go out. Outside, disease doesn't spread as well. We're inside, and we're trapped inside. When they do a study on where, on the temperature that flu spreads the best in, it's actually about the temperature of those breezeways. You know, we come in from outside, so it's a little cooler than inside the building, but it's not as cold as outside of the building. So a little bit cooler temperature might help facilitate transmission. It's a probably multifactorial basis, but the reality is we can pretty well predict cold and flu season every year based on when it gets colder, right? So there's something in that that makes it doesn't mean that's the only time you can get flu. So we have flu cases all the way around the year, but certainly much, much, much more during cold and flu season.
And I guess you could factor into that the fact that we're getting together more often in the holidays. You know, you got maybe, you know, people that may not see each other for 11 months and 3 weeks of the year spend a week together at Christmas or Thanksgiving.
Yeah, and we're all cooped up close to each other, things like that. So certainly it's more complex than one factor, but the net result is every year we just know that we're going to have cold and flu season, and we'll see a lot more of that.
So if we say literally it's because it's colder, that's not necessarily true. But the factors that involve it being colder, you know, the breezeways and the going from one temperature to another and spending more time indoors, that's the stuff that really matters.
Yeah, I think so.
Interesting. All right. Dr. Blodgett is, of course, the general man. I don't know, what do they call you? The boss guy of the health department. Southwest Utah Public Health Department officer, chief officer. Yeah, I don't know do you have an official?
They actually have a title for public health directors. It's called a health officer.
Okay.
Nationwide.
You're an officer?
Created in the law, yeah. There used to be that we'd carry badges around, like, you know.
Right. The health department badge, yeah.
Stuff like that, but we don't do that too much anymore.
I'm curious with your job. I did a story yesterday on our website about stress and the most stressful jobs in America. And, you know, you got the usual suspects, the air traffic controller, the police dispatcher, the policeman himself. Maybe if you work in a high-rise office, you're a construction worker in a, you know, building, high-rise buildings. Those are pretty stressful. I'm curious, and by the way, surgeons was on the top 10 list of most stressful occupations out there. What about a health officer? Is that a... I mean, in a way, it could be the most stressful job because you're responsible for these couple hundred thousand people in your district. But in another way, people tend not to listen to our health officer very often. And so I guess that would take...
reduce stress or increase stress? Yeah. I don't know. Public health is the intersection between science of medicine and the politics. And so in
that's
some
not
ways,
an enviable spot to be in right now.
Yeah, so in some ways you set yourself up to be you're never quite able to get everybody happy with you, right? There's always somebody unhappy. Sure. You're never quite able to deliver on the promise of what could be there because funding and you know, just human nature and all of that stuff. But in other situations, it's incredibly rewarding to say, look, you know, we're engaged in something that's really meaningful and impactful, right? Sometimes I think part of stress is you just don't feel like, even if things were to go right, that it would make much difference. It's that feeling of helplessness, and you know, that's not something that I have to deal with. So there are times, it's, you know, more stressful than probably anything you could, you know, want to do. COVID was a great example of that.
You were right in it with COVID. You had one side accusing you of some things and the other side accusing you of other things, and you're just trying to make the right decision.
It's strange. I've become this controversial figure, you know. Like I go out and speak on exercise in public or something, there's people there mad that, you know, I talk about vaccines, and there's people mad that I, you know, just we've become so polarized on almost every issue that you can't even just address the idea of living healthier lives without something, you know, triggering somebody. So that's, you know, as our society fractures on just about any issue you can fracture on, I think it makes the work of physicians and politicians and public servants across the board more difficult, and that certainly is true in public health as well.
So I've been a sports enthusiast my whole life, a sports writer and broadcaster for 35 years. I remember when my boys were young, they needed a coach for their football team and basketball later, but football first. And I remember I was like, if no one else will do it, I'll do it. You know, and that's kind of how those things come about. But I ended up coach of their flag football team. I didn't literally get an ulcer, but I was so stressed out because of the nature of my job as a sports guy, a sports writer, sports broadcaster. I felt like the success of how I coach these kids was going to reflect, people were going to look at me and go, he's a sports writer. He's a sports broadcaster. He better be a good coach.
So
I wondered now with you being a public health official, do you feel that in your life? Are people looking at you and your family and your relatives and people around you and saying, he better be good at what he does on a personal level, because look at what he does on a public level.
Yeah, you know, you don't ever want to go out to eat with people, because then you know they'll look at what you eat.
Like, that guy ordered French fries. He just told me I'm not supposed to. Yeah.
I guess in all things there's the ideal and then there's the reality, right? And somehow we're trying to get a little better at a whole lot of things all the time. That's the quest of life, right? We want to be a little better at our parenting. We want to be a little better at our health and how we eat and how we sleep. All of these things kind of fit into this quest to be the best we can be. And I think that's part of the joy of living is this idea that, you know, this goal of good things to come is always out in front of us. And I hope that's part of the message that we have coming out of the work that we do is just a little bit of an encouragement on your quest to be the best and healthiest you can be, you know, as we can be a partner in that. But I'm not sure sometimes people perceive it that way.
You know? Do you put pressure on yourself then? I've got to be healthy. My family's got to be healthy because everyone's looking to me.
I think we all do. Right?
Kind of like the bishop of your neighborhood. He better be the most righteous dude around, right? Or he drinks Dr. Pepper. What?
And sometimes I think we judge those things on premises that just don't exist.
Yeah, it's
right?
Not fair. I mean,
we can't impose our perception on other people, but unfortunately, I think we do that way too much.
I have a couple of stories from the news today that I thought I could get the good doctor to comment on. These are completely unrehearsed. He has no idea what they're about, and I actually kind of like it that way. I don't know if he does or not. I know there's pressure on you, but this one from this morning off the wire. ChatGPT might not be a reliable source for medication-related questions. A study by pharmacists at Long Island University found that the free version of ChatGPT provided inaccurate or incomplete answers to questions about drugs. Other responses didn't directly address the questions, but rather evaded the question. A lead author of the study says patients should be wary when using viral chatbot for drug information, and responses should be verified by a doctor, which I'm sure is the real answer. You talk to a real doctor about this. But it kind of leads into the whole self-diagnosis thing. I see these comments. I've even seen them in doctor's offices that say, hey, don't come in with your diagnosis of what you think you have based on what you read online. And yet then I talk to other people, say, well, you've got to be your own advocate when you go to the doctor, because a doctor sees, you know, hundreds and hundreds of patients throughout the course of a year. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the same problem we've had with the internet for a long time because you read it on the internet, it must be true, right? and all ChatGPT does is combine all of that, synthesize all that information that's out there and try and come to a kind of a core out of that. And it's interesting because they have sources they like better than others. Sometimes those are wrong, or there'll be a loud voice, or, you know, it says it just the way they wanted to hear it with the whatever, however you typed in the question. And so So there's some peril there, right, when you're trying to get to the cause of what's going on. But then there's also an idea that maybe it can give you a flag that says, I really ought to go get this looked at, right?
Right, and, that's true.
So I don't begrudge any effort to learn and understand better and do better. I think where we run into trouble is when we're not willing to acknowledge that there's a wide array of potential sources for information,
okay. Yeah.
And that we rely exclusively on one and don't think critically about what it's telling us, things like that. So I think it's here to stay, the AI, and I think we have to figure out what it means for us and how to use it reasonably and how to be wise about it. And I don't know. Some of the things they're claiming about the future of AI is
a little scary.
Concerning a little bit, you know. And we'll have to, we'll track the progress of that. But you're right. You're the only true advocate for yourself, and you need to be careful, no matter what that source is, to make sure it makes sense and that you have identified trusted sources that you can go to kind of work through those issues, and that it kind of gels with what you think is right and wrong. So.
I like what you said in that, use that as a tool, as part of the picture. Don't paint your whole picture with what you read based on ChatGPT or even just some internet research, but actually use that as part of the picture. There are people that go to the extreme one way. I have my mother-in-law, she's passed away now, but she was an incredible hypochondriac. She would read something about something. I remember one time, remember when your kids are little and you swing them around in a circle by their arms? She had read that a certain percent of people that swing their children by their arms dislocate their children and cause them future grief and with their shoulders and later they're going to have bursitis or whatever, all this stuff. And she was just on. I was swinging one of my kids, at the park, and she was on me about it. And I'm like, what are you talking about? She said, well, I read. And I knew right then I was in trouble, because no matter how many times I had done that, and I had done that with all my kids for years, that she read somewhere, and so it had to be true. And so she took it that extreme, that to the one extreme. On the other hand, I think if, like you were saying, if you can go in and you can say, look, I have these symptoms and these things, and this could be one of the things, I don't think a doctor is going to be offended, right? If you go in and say, hey, I think I might have this, but if you have other ideas, let's talk about them all.
Well, there's a reason why you're at the doctor, right, is to get his opinion on things. And let's face it, doctors aren't infallible either, right?
Right.
So it's all part of this constellation of what we're trying to get to, which is a better healthcare system, a better, better health, better kind of overall approach to things, and people that are empowered and actively engaged in their own health.
And I will say this about doctors. The thing that you get from them that you don't get necessarily from the internet is experience. If I go to my doctor and I've got this problem, it's my elbow hurts, whatever. Chances are, if that doctor really is seeing hundreds of patients every year and he's been practicing, I think my current general practitioner has been practicing maybe 15 years. He's literally seen thousands of people, and there's a pretty good chance several of them had the same thing I have. That's experience.
Well, and it's not just experience. It's the nuance that comes with experience, right? Mm. You can say, how do these things all fit together, right? How does that fit together with the medications you're taking? How does it fit with, family history, with previous things that have happened, with, what am I seeing that's out there right now that could be impacting this? It's so much more nuanced than a Google search, right? And that requires some real knowledge background, some capacity to make those connections, and that's how they're trained. So there's a reason we have doctors around, for sure.
Yeah, nuance is one of those words. I think a lot of people are like, no, what do you mean by nuance? Imagine trying to open a bottle with a corkscrew versus a sledgehammer.
Yeah.
That's nuance. There's for nuance, you. Yeah, so, and that actually leads into, one of the things I wanted to talk about today was doctors in America. We have, I read like four different studies this morning, and the estimate is there's between 38,000 and 150,000 fewer doctors in America than we really need for the population we have. I don't know. Maybe you have better knowledge about this specific area we're in, the area in which you're the public health official. But it feels like, especially if you need a specialist, try seeing a neurologist in this town. Yeah. Good luck 8, 10, 12 months from now getting in. There are shortages. Is it something we should be worried about? Is it a big concern, or is it something that we'll get through?
Medical care is an interesting phenomenon that way, because we tend to create demand based on who's there, right?
Okay.
Let me illustrate my point.
Okay.
When I was a kid, there wasn't a urologist in Southern Utah. Zero.
None.
Right?
Really?
Zero. And so if you were a primary care doc and somebody came in, they had kidney stones or, you know, some kind of basic urological situation going on, the doc just treated it, right? You got just some pain meds and, you know, helped it pass and stuff like that. Now you refer those to the urologist.
Yeah.
And so there's this creep in specialization that happens when the specialists are available.
Huh.
And that's part of the increasing cost of healthcare and things like that. And so part of the problem we have in healthcare is there is no central decision-making capacity
for how do we
treat certain diseases? How do we help people navigate the system? How do we make sure a care is appropriate? How do we not, you know, 30% of the healthcare dollar goes into the last week of life. 60% goes into the last year. You know, I mean, we've got some real, if we're going to make healthcare sustainable and work the way it should and all of those kind of things, we have to have some more systematic discussions about healthcare. We've never been able to do that in our system. And so what you see is it's not universal shortages. It's specialty based, it's location based, and you know, and so, is there an oversupply in some places? Yes. Is there an undersupply in other places? You know, it was always about the primary care crisis when I was in medical school, and I think there are still some shortages there. There's certain specialties that it's really hard to get people to go into because it's just not as pleasant and doesn't pay as well, you know. And so all of that factors in, but I think core to all of that is how do we have some just basic level discussions about what a healthcare system should look like that would be better than what it is? And I don't know how you get to those discussions, but if we don't do some things to help right the ship in healthcare, we're going to end up with a system that fails and then tries to rebuild itself, and that's probably going to end up worse than if we had an intelligent discussion about how to move it forward, you know. So
what do you tell people that say, well, hey, look at Sweden or some of the socialized medicine, you know, where everybody, healthcare is free. Yeah. It's not free, but what do you tell people that say, well, maybe that's where we should be going?
Yeah, they have their difficulties too, right? Yeah. There's no perfect system, and I think, you know, there's health policy and management, that's this part of this that, you know, we need to start to have some conscientious discussions about in the country, and we try over the years, but it really comes down to the patient deciding who to go see and the doctor deciding what specialty go into when they're coming out of medical school, and so it ends up in these variables that just don't sometimes make sense for the overall system. So.
All right, got to get a weather break in. Talking with Dr. Blodgett today. If you'd like to call or text, actually got a lot of texts of that action lately. So if you want to text me, it's 435-467-5842. We'd love to hear from you. The studio line is 673-5890. The text line again, 467-5842.
Not afraid to tell it like it is.
A very smart cookie.
The Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5, KDXU, Southern Utah's news talk leader.
That liner cracks me up. It calls me a very smart cookie. I am a smart cookie because I bring smart people in who know what they're talking about, and so then I can just listen to guys like Dr. Blodgett here. It is a smart cookie.
Yeah, you're
so, Dr. Blodgett, thanks again for coming in. It's always good to see you. I know that first Wednesday of every month is covered.
Yeah, it's fun to do. Thank you, Andy.
A couple of other things from, and then we'll get back to healthcare a little bit. A couple of things from the Wire today. Doctors say a new syndrome that's been identified in some newborn infants may be related to fentanyl exposure. The recently published findings showed that at least 10 babies who were born to mothers who had used fentanyl have been identified with distinctive birth defects, including cleft palate and small heads. The researchers say no common genetic cause has been uncovered besides the fentanyl. The study's co-authors add that much more work is needed to confirm the findings, but early findings are that fentanyl might be the worst drug ever. It's killing people. It's now apparently causing birth defects in children, and it's, I don't know, people are saying it's being made in China, or the pieces of it are being made in China and shipped right to the U.S. And,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, 80,000-ish people died last year from fentanyl overdoses. So,
wait, what was the number on flu last year? 60,000?
60 to 80.
So more people died from fentanyl than the flu.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, well, I mean, so we have debates about guns. Guns are in the kind of 10 to 15,000 range, you know. So
wow.
This is, heart disease, the king of all of our health killers, is 400 to 600, depending on how you ask the question.
Five times as many.
So, we don't do well differentiating risk, right? But this is, of those that take illegal drugs, of those that take fentanyl, the fatality rate is incredibly high. Because it's so packed with, the capacity to overdose is... The quality control is terrible. I mean, I can't believe we're talking about quality control in an illegal drug, but people take it casually and then, they die. And so that it is not a long-term health activity. So.
Is it... Because we don't take it as seriously, is it because somehow in our minds the general public goes, well, they're taking that drug, some of them deserve to die, and they had a bad lifestyle, so they deserve to get heart disease. Well, people that get shot by a gun didn't deserve that. Is that how we're able to justify? I don't get it.
I think it's what you pay attention to, what you call attention to, is what you tend to. To notice, and so when we have these community health assessments where we go out and ask people, what is it that you think are the biggest issues that we're facing in our society and stuff, and invariably it tends to mirror whatever was on the news the night before, right? So I'm not sure that's a really great way to set priorities for a public health agency like ours, but that's all the rage right now. But I think the deeper message is, if it's not something that we raise pay attention to and focus on, it's not something people are going to incorporate in their life and things like that. And so that's why we have these efforts to try and make sure people are aware. What is it that people die from? What are the risk factors for those kind of things? Things like that.
It's like pop. I mean, this is stupid. This is really stupid. But if Taylor Swift put out a 2-minute YouTube video talking about the dangers of drinking Kool-Aid,
that would be the
thing, right? Millions of people would Google it and ChatGPT, and you would be dealing with people calling the health office going, "Hey, I got like 10 packets of Kool-Aid in my cupboard. Am I safe?" It's true, isn't it? Yeah. It would really happen.
We struggled for years and years and years and years to get people to do some sort of colon cancer screening, right? We've talked about the various ways you can do that, and the rates were like 12% of Americans would get screened for colon cancer. But then Katie Couric
Right.
I don't know if you remember this.
Yeah.
Has a colonoscopy on TV and talks about colon cancer, and then all of a sudden the rate shoots up to 50% or 60%, something like that. So the celebrity factor in our society is a strange phenomenon for sure.
That's wild. I guess it's almost, from your perspective, then it's almost impossible to tell what's going to be the next public awareness thing out there. As hard as you, as health officials try to say, we need to talk about heart disease, we need to talk about, you know, influenza, whatever, as much as you try to steer the conversation, it's kind of out of your control sometimes, isn't it?
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes we just have to identify what the trend is and do good teaching around that, right? And so if the trend
feet,
is crazy, then we have to say, well, maybe that's not so good. And hopefully you have enough credibility that people will at least tap the brakes a little bit if it's super crazy.
Never was that more evident, I guess, in March of 2020.
Yeah.
When the world went a little crazy about COVID.
Yeah, it turned out to be a political and media response, not a good public health response for sure.
Yeah, and that's not the way it's supposed to work.
No.
It was the tail wagging the dog, basically.
It was, and we, you know, did really, some unfortunate policies came out of that that just, people don't respond well to force, right? And I think recommendations are awesome because then people can choose whether they're going to make that part of what they want to do. And, so public health has always been in that line, right? Here's cold and flu season coming up. Here's what we recommend, right? As soon as you start saying you must do it, the mandate part of it, you lose people. And then people spend more time trying to figure out how to get around the mandate than they do what the mandate was supposed to be about. But there's a lot of people that think that's where we should go immediately every time is some sort of force people into what they should do. I think the data is clear. When you do that, you've lost your capacity to have much of an effective response.
I'm developing an analogy here with parenthood.
Yeah.
And I remember I had one son that did not want to keep the rules to the point where I did the mandate thing as a parent. I said, look, these are the rules. If you can't live under these rules, you're going to have to move out. It was in 90% of it was bluff. I didn't want him to leave.
Yeah,
I just wanted him to stop breaking the rules. But he left. And I learned the hard way, kind of what you're just saying. You can mandate if you want to. And I know there are parents out there that are saying, yeah, but you've got to set rules. We did set rules.
Yeah.
But sometimes you have to lose the battle, a very painful battle. And I still think about it. This was 10 years ago. I still think about, you know, we went out to dinner, came back, and he left a note and took his stuff and was gone. And you know, as a parent, that's painful. That hurts. But I think in the long run, he understood what we were all about. But in the short term, I mean, it's exactly what you were saying. You go hard line, and people are gonna resist. They're gonna say no.
We have a great example of that in the smoking arena, where and they figured this out. So that in you know, for Since the 60s, they've had this concept in advertising called psychological reactance, where if people perceive a threat to their freedom, liberty, self-choice capacity, they almost always do exactly the opposite of what you want. So,
are we talking Americans? Or are we talking about anyone?
Just anyone.
Okay.
Right. So advertising, in the advertising world, they're smart. They're always... It's always about how cool you are if you do it, how everybody wants to do this, you know, good-looking people sitting around doing it, you know, that kind of thing.
They used to sell beer by putting women in bikinis.
In the government world, it's you should not do this. This is bad, right? So, so what do? We stick on a pack of cigarettes. Smoking will
kill you.
Will, you know, cause birth defects or whatever. And it's all black and white. You know, it's all very direct statements, very, you know, condemning sounding almost. And the studies are those might as well be tobacco ads, because what they say is, you know, Big Brother is telling you not to, but you see the tobacco ad.
You're free.
You know, it's the Marlboro Man. He's out, you know, riding his horse. That the psychological reactants almost always triggers the opposite response. Even though cognitively people might say, well, I might understand what they're trying to say here, the gut level response is to go the opposite direction of what that kind of forced thing is. And so how much of that, of what we did in COVID, was in the exact wrong line, right? You can't be a healthcare worker unless you get vaccinated.
Yeah.
Well, so lots of healthcare workers walked away from their jobs, right? They were, and a lot of them probably got flu shots every year. They just, there is just this fundamental capacity of human nature that says, if you're trying to force me to do it, there must be something wrong here, and I need to, not be there. So some people will respond, a great deal will not, but almost always it backfires in the end, because then you have people that actively seek to undermine what you've been trying to do with the mandate to begin with. So, so the data is pretty clear, didn't really do anything, so we basically tried to kill our society, and we didn't get much out of it because of the way it was approached. Whereas recommendations and giving people this idea of you're the one in charge here to do the best that you can, I think would have done just as well as what we did, or better.
All right, got to get a commercial break in. KDXU News Time is 9:49. If you have a question for Dr. Blodgett, text me right now, 435-467-5842. Welcome back. I'm Andy. Dr. Blodgett here as well. Dr. Blodgett is younger than me, a little bit, and somehow found the time during all those years to go to medical school and be chief resident at Johns Hopkins and all these things, all while I was running around the West chasing football games and basketball games on the radio. So
they're all good things.
Good for you,
Good for you, too.
For me, I did raise 5 kids along the way as well. How many kids do you have, Dr. Blodgett?
I have 3.
You have 3 kids. All right.
Yeah.
And what are their ages at this point?
Well, I got one that's 20.
20, okay.
One that's 17 and one that's 15. So,
ooh, you are in the teenage years.
Yeah. My 20-year-old's in New Zealand.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
What is it? A girl? What's she doing there?
She's a missionary.
Missionary. Awesome. Very cool. Is there any kind of language barrier involved there?
No, she speaks English, but
English, but it's English.
She's only got 4 or 5 more months now, but
I had a companion on my mission in Philadelphia from New Zealand.
Yeah.
So yeah, which is, by the way, a lot bigger than people even realize. New Zealand's a big country.
It's bigger.
Two islands, right?
It's beautiful. 2 big islands. Yeah. 2 islands. She's on the North Island.
Are you going to go pick her up in a few months?
Yeah, we're going to try and go see her.
Man, that's pretty awesome.
Be a once in a lifetime trip,
And a 17 and a 15-year-old teenager right now.
Yeah.
Huh?
Senior and sophomore.
I don't miss those days. I'm not going to lie. I don't miss those days. My baby is turning 20 here in a couple weeks, and just got married.
Each stage of life has its good and bad, for sure.
And I think my daughter just got off her mission since I saw you last, month.
Congratulations to her.
She is, she speaks Spanish. She went to Chile on her mission.
Okay.
And, sometimes when they come back from missions, they're a little bit weird, especially if they went to a foreign country. But my daughter, I have to say, is instead of being weird, she's just her same person, only like 2.0, like the improved version.
Yeah.
So I'm happy.
Sure, a lot of growth that goes on when you engage in something where you put yourself out there to help other people. And it's been a great thing for our family.
Yeah, awesome. Awesome. A couple of things. Now, you had something you wanted to... Oh, the magazine's coming out.
Yeah, so the latest issue, the winter issue of our magazine, is coming out. It should hit mailboxes in the next few days.
Okay.
The overall focus of the magazine is healthy aging through the lifespan. We had Diabetes Month this last month, where we had a big focus on, trying to get people in to get screened and for diabetes, but... we really want people to be aware of some of these issues. Talk about falls, Alzheimer's disease, healthy exercise through the lifespan, you know, things like that. So I think it's a great, if you're older, it's great advice for what things you could do now. If you're younger, it's kind of a vision into how can I do to keep away from some of these things that are really afflicting society. So you look at the rates of Alzheimer's disease as they increase dramatically in society, rates of diabetes, all of these kinds of things that we see more of as people age are going up in the wrong direction, and we need to, you know, but there's some basic things you can do to prevent all that that are really important. So the younger you start, the better off you are. So hopefully that's the take-home message from this magazine.
We had we talked a little bit about Huntsman Senior Games yesterday with Marianne on the show, and I think it's important people to understand that when we say exercise, we're not telling you go do 50 jumping jacks.
Yeah.
Go, you know, run around the track 16 times or whatever. That's not what we're talking about. You got to find something that works for you, because if you don't like it, you're not going to keep doing it. So you got to find something. For me right now, I found pickleball. Most of my life, it was basketball. Unfortunately, I have some health problems and can't do basketball anymore. So I found pickleball. My wife and I can play together. It's fun, and it gets us out exercising. Mm-hmm. But I think that whether it's pickleball, whether it's volleyball, whether it's, you know, going for a walk, whatever. Yeah. You know?
Well, the impact of just small amounts of exercise on your overall health and well-being is dramatic. And that there's a study that I'm going to be talking about with my staff here coming out, where they took people that were 85 and older,
okay,
and put them on a supervised weightlifting regime for 15 minutes a day. And then they documented the increase in muscle mass, but also the increased balance and stuff. So a lot of what you associate frailty with as you age is just loss of muscle and things like that. And the study showed that just with that 15 minutes a day, they increased their muscle mass by 15% to 20%, their balance by 30%, you know, things like that. So it can have a dramatic impact on your life with not a ton of extra effort. Consistently, the very best exercise for the lifespan is walking. It's simple. You don't have to have any special equipment. You don't have to do anything funky. Just get out and spend 20, 30 minutes walking and build it into your life. Park a little further away from the store. You know, do things that that increase your walking each day, and you'll see a positive benefit from that.
I don't know what the public health stance is on this, but we have an older building we're in. We're on the third floor.
Yeah.
It's stupid, but I actually am happy that we're on the third floor and there's no elevator. I have to climb a couple of flights of stairs twice a day, two or three times a day.
Walking stairs
does
good things for you, right? We've had challenges in our office where we hike Mount Everest or something by the number of flights of stairs we do, things like that. It makes a difference. The sitting doesn't help, but just a little bit of extra effort to get up and move does a whole lot.
I feel like I'm trying to talk myself into it. I am a little bit. Dr. Blodgett, thanks for coming on today.
Sure, great to be here. Thanks again.
We've got to move on. Tomorrow, Mayor Michelle Randall will be with me live on the program, and we've got Open Line Friday coming up in a couple of days. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Andy. We'll talk to you tomorrow.